WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actor Chris Eigmann is best known for his roles in Whit Stillman's films Metropolitan, Barcelona, and his current film The Last Days of Disco, in which Eigmann plays the manager of the disco. Eigmann is also starring in Noah Baumbach's new film Mr. Jealousy. He plays Annabella Sciorra's former boyfriend, who her current boyfriend, Eric Stoltz, is insanely jealous of. Stoltz has even joined Eigmann's group therapy sessions under an assumed identity to find out more about him. What worries Stoltz most is that passionate sex scenes in Eigmann's novel are really based on Stoltz's girlfriend. And Stoltz thinks Eigmann has come close to admitting that in a former session, so Stoltz keeps getting Eigmann to talk about the novel. In this scene, Eigmann is talking about the novel and how he deals with it with his current girlfriend, Irene.
The other night, feeling guilty, I told Irene that the character in my book, Charlotte, the one who takes part in the erotic sex scene, was based on an actual girlfriend of mine.
You told the truth.
Charlotte was a girl I dated in New York after college. The real Charlotte, God, my memory is terrible. The real Charlotte was a bit of a tart.
A what?
What a Philip Roth character might call a chippy. She had a number of lovers for a woman her age, at least in my experience. In college, she dated a lot of those younger teachers that everybody had crushes on. The guys wanted to be, the girls wanted to f***. One history teacher in particular used to bother me a lot then. Now I am one of those guys.
Chris Eigmann, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
Let me ask you to describe your character in Mr. Jealousy.
Dashiell is a writer who's written one book that sort of gets heralded as a sort of like zeitgeist novel of Manhattan and young Manhattanites, not dissimilar to, say, you know, Bright Lights, Big City, Less Than Zero. And Noah and I sort of modeled the character on a lot of those guys, and also up to and including David Foster Wallace. Certainly the way David Foster Wallace looks, because when he had done, I guess, Infinite Jest, he had his dust jacket. He had like long hair and sort of scruffy face, and we were like, this is who we want this to be.
Now, he's somebody who is an ambiguous figure during a lot of the movie. You don't know whether you should dislike him like the Eric Stoltz character does, because
right.
He's so jealous of him, or whether, you know, he's a good writer and a likable guy. So how did you see him inhabiting the character?
This was the first character that I've ever played who never, ever lies. He only tells the truth. There's no reason for Dashiell to lie. You meet him most of the time in therapy, where it's completely counterproductive to lie. And for a long time when I was doing the part, there was this ill-fitting feeling to the whole thing where I wasn't sure why things felt the way. And I was like, oh, it's because the character's never lying. So in my view, you know, Dashiell's a great guy. He's incredibly sweet. He's good-natured. He means well. He hopes for the best. He's trying to get better. He's trying to be a better writer. He wonders if he even can be a good writer. He wonders about the success and whether it's earned or just sort of happened. So that was my take on Dashiell.
Now, Noah Baumbach said that he was really surprised at some of your line readings.
Yeah, I heard him say that, and I went through it in my head, like, which lines could we be talking about?
Well, what do you think?
I don't know. I do think that I have, it's either, you know, nurture and nature, but I do have some specific timing things that I will do that, you know, they can help or they can hinder, but I suspect that's what he's talking about.
You also always seem to play characters that are kind of confrontational.
Yeah.
Whether they're lying or telling the truth, they just kind of, they're very blunt and they just say it.
I know. I don't know what in me attracts writer directors to have me do that stuff. I don't think that's the way I am particularly, but that's the way I come off or something.
Well,
my wife, I think, has a different take on that. She's like, no, you are that way.
No. Describe your character in The Last Days of Disco.
Dez is he's sort of a club manager, or the under manager of a club that's not dissimilar to Studio 54, who spends his time trying to bring his friends into the disco. And his friends are these, they're almost like proto-yuppies. I mean, it's before, yuppie is this word that just starts getting thrown around right at this time, and it's not a compliment. And so I spend my days trying to get these guys into the club. So I'm sort of like Normandy Beach to these guys. If they can just get to me, I can get them in the club.
Let's hear a scene from the film.
Yuppie scum? In college, before dropping out, I took a course in the propaganda uses of language. One objective is to deny other people's humanity or even right to exist.
In the men's lounge, someone scrawled, "Kill yuppie scum."
Do yuppies even exist? No one says, "I am a yuppie." It's always the other guy who's a yuppie. I think for a group to exist, somebody has to admit to be part of it.
Of course yuppies exist. Most people would say you two are prime specimens.
We're not yuppies.
You think we're yuppies?
You're seriously saying you're not yuppies?
No. Yuppie stands for young, upwardly mobile professional. Nightclub flunky is not a professional category.
Contrary to popular belief, junior level...
Now, where were you, Chris Eigenman, during the disco era? Did you participate in any way?
No, I pretty much sat it out. I'm old enough or young enough just to have missed it. I grew up in Denver, and so when disco hit, say, in about 1970, I don't know, two or three, Denver didn't have an enormous disco horizon. I remember that there were two of them, and one of the discos that you know, where parents were going to, or friends' parents were going to, was a steakhouse during the day, and then at night, they like swept all the gristle off to one side and dropped down a disco ball, and it became a disco. But it was, I don't know whether it's still there or not, but it was at this really sort of prominent corner in Denver, and you always drove by it, and all the kids knew something was going on here. And it was called the London Broil, which I thought was just fantastic. Like, if you had to come up with a name that works both for a disco and a steakhouse, that's it.
Oh, that's great. That's
I mean, to this day, I wonder whether it's there. I'm sure I'll get a chance to go back and look for it. Or I'll be sued by whoever it is that owns it.
Let's fix it up for the kids at night.
Uh-huh.
Oh, so
it's just amazing.
Did you dance?
No, I actually... dancing is something that never came easily to me. I'm a lousy dancer. In fact, on disco, they hired a choreographer because I was supposed to dance like everybody else in the film. And the guy, the first day of dance rehearsals or whatever, taught me the hustle. And I really tried to learn it. I dutifully, you know, memorized the steps and where you clap and all of that. And then I went home and showed my wife, who laughed incredibly hard, and it was laughter directed at me. It was not supportive. It was not friendly. It was a "you look like an idiot" kind of laugh. And the next day, the guy tried to teach me something else, and it wasn't going well. And then I would go back to the production office where there'd be big charts for the dance numbers, and my name was systematically being crossed off each dance routine. So apparently, my dancing caused nausea in both the choreographer and others, so I was just cut.
My guest is Chris Eigenman. He's starring in two films, The Last Days of Disco and Mr. Jealousy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Chris Eigenman. He's starring in two films, Mr. Jealousy and The Last Days of Disco. Now, most of your film experience so far is in the films of Whit Stillman and Noah Baumbach.
You've been
in each of their films.
Yeah.
Their films are about two different worlds. Whit Stillman's films are about the world of people who grew up in wealthy families.
Yeah, or a certain amount of privilege and all of that.
Right, and who are from the kind of circle where, you know, the women in the circle were debutantes. Mm-hmm. And Noah Baumbach's films are more about people who come out of a more kind of bohemian kind of background. Though the ages of this are similar in... though that's not true, because the era is more of 1980s for Whit Stillman's. But anyways.
Well, but the characters' ages
The characters' ages are similar, exactly.
Which is good, because otherwise I'd have to put on a fake mustache or something to play
there
them.
There you go. Do you feel more connected to either of those worlds? The bohemian world or, you know, the debutante world?
Wow, no one's ever asked me that before. I think, you know, in all honesty, I straddle both. which sounds like a cop-out, but it's actually true. My sister in Denver was a Deb, and I, you know, did that whole routine. I escorted her down the steps. I got dressed up like an idiot, all of that stuff. But yet I went to, you know, I went to a high school in Vermont called Putney that is some would call very liberal or bohemian. I mean, I loved it. I thought it was the best education I could have gotten. And when I was at high school, I was asked to escort somebody in New York to a Deb party, and I took the bus out of Vermont and came down to New York City, and the mother saw me, and I had really long hair. I had hair down to about my mid-back, and I had two earrings in, and I was wearing clogs. And I was immediately put back on the bus and not allowed to escort the girl at whatever ball it was. So, you know, it's you know, a bit of this, a bit of that.
Right. So how did you get your first part in a Whit Stillman movie, which was Metropolitan, the movie that's specifically about debutantes and their escorts?
I read an audition announcement in the trades in New York, and I'd been in New York for really only about a year. And I went to the audition, which was a cattle call. It was, you know, everybody, it seemed, was there. Thousands of people were standing in a line. The line snaked out of the building. The audition was like on the fourth floor, and the line snaked through the stairs and out onto Lafayette Street and down the street. So I lived really close by, so I kind of grabbed a number and went back home and hung out. And then went through that audition. And then the auditions kept going for about 4 months. They started in about fall. And it was well into December before the last audition. And the last audition was, I was sitting in a room with a lot of Whit's producers, who, three or four of these guys, who were these very well-dressed, young, kind of scary-looking guys. And they knew that they had my fortune in their hands to make or break as they saw fit. And they weren't being very nice about the whole experience. And one of the young producers crossed his legs, and I noticed that a price tag was dangling off his sock. And I mentioned that if he wanted to become a real producer, he should learn to take the price tags off his clothes.
And what a nice way of putting it.
Well, and they didn't laugh. No one laughed, but Whit laughed. Whit kind of cackled in the background. And I actually think that got me the job. I think, again, sort of going back to what you talked about originally, is the guy who just says it, which is something occasionally I can do in life. And thankfully was able to do it in that moment.
No, but what went through your mind when you were saying that? Because that could definitely be a make or break moment. And though it turned out to be a make moment, it could have easily been a, what a jerk.
Rid of this guy. How did you ever consider him? I don't know. I think I had just sort of had it with these idiots who were sitting around. And you know, there's a part of being an actor that's always unpleasant, which is that constant judging thing that goes on in rooms, you know, and that's the part that I never handle particularly well. I always get irritated at it. So I'm sure that's what was coming to the forefront.
Now, it's funny because in Last Days of Disco, the character that you're playing is the character that always has to evaluate the people who want to get into the disco and decide who's worthy, who's kind of beautiful enough to be, who's hip and beautiful enough to be let in. So you're in that position that makes the judgments, and
you're
on the other end of that. Yeah,
exactly. Which also explains why I, as a human being, have never gone to a disco and have never stood on the other side of the velvet rope, because there's enough rejection in my life I wouldn't want to go out and search for it at night for recreation.
Well, how much rejection has there been in your life? Have you lost out on a lot of roles that you tried to get?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know, somebody came up with some statistic. I doubt it's true, but it might be close, which is, At your best game, an actor lands about 1 out of 20 jobs, 1 out of 30, something like that. I remember I got a job right after Metropolitan. I went to Hollywood to do a TV pilot, and it was a job that I was not—I was very proud to have gotten, but didn't really want. It wasn't a great job, and I always sort of felt queasy about taking it. But I took it, and then I got fired from it, which sort of taught me the lesson of, you know, there's like three kinds of jobs. There's the really the good job that you'd kill to do, and then there's the lousy job that you know you would never do, but then there's this middle area, and at some point after the firing, I decided I'd like to stay away from even the little, you know, the middle area, the gray area, and only do jobs that I would really love, which explains why, you know, I've worked with two directors solely.
You have this knack of when you take characters who, in some ways, are very unlikable, of still making them kind of likable, you know,
yeah.
You find the sympathetic part in them, and I'm wondering what the trick to that is.
I don't know, but it's nice to hear that it worked. I think that there are maybe two ways of looking at acting, and one of the ways is, you know, put on the rubber nose and change your voice a little bit, and that's sort of, you know, the Olivier thing, and then there's the Spencer Tracy thing of just standing where you're supposed to stand and tell the truth. And I tend to do the Spencer Tracy thing, but as a result of that, it means I drag all the characters that I'm playing over to me. So hopefully, whatever sort of sympathetic qualities you're sensing might actually be mine.
Mm-hmm. You know what I also think really works for you in the roles that you take? You tend to play very kind of verbal people.
Yeah.
And I think you just handle that really well, that you really have a knack for that kind of verbal interplay and forgetting the kind of smartness that these characters have.
Right, yeah. I think that, I mean, I'm much happier with the sort of long, beefy speech as opposed to the sort of quick, clever banter.
Right.
Which is why, you know, doing Mr. Jealousy was you know, a walk in the park for me. I loved it because it was these huge monologues that I got to sit and do, and trying to find the corners in them and trying to find the humor in them. And, you know, that was fantastic. When I see a page that's, you know, three lines, all of whom have to be funny, I you know, that's like, oh no, now I'm at sixes and sevens and I'm not sure what to do with it.
When you worked on Whit Stillman's middle film, Barcelona, I read that you gave up smoking while making the movie.
And
I'm wondering, like, what went through your mind to give up smoking during such an important period when you were probably really tense and there was so much at stake? It's probably the last time that most people would think of.
We were in Spain where everybody smoked also.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, it made it even harder. I don't know. I felt that I was slowly but surely losing all control over my life. Which is not an unfamiliar feeling when you make a movie, especially when, and that was the first movie I ever made where it was, it's the only movie I ever made where it was out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, everything was about the film. Every waking hour, every sleeping hour was about the movie. And I'd started smoking when I was like 13 or something, and I loved it. I just thought it was about, I mean, to this day, I miss it. And I knew that this would not be a bad time to quit because I felt everything sort of slipping away from me and I needed to get some control over my life. So I quit smoking in the middle of the film. Now, Whit, I don't think has forgiven me for it. Because apparently I became pretty difficult towards the latter days of that shoot. And apparently on Disco, there was a rider on everyone's contract which said if you smoke today, you must continue to smoke throughout the film and you are not allowed to quit. I don't know. It just seemed like the right time to do it.
Now, if you were offered a role that you liked, but it required the character to smoke, would you take the role knowing that it might get you hooked again on cigarettes?
Well, yeah, there's actually in Mr. Jealousy and Disco, I smoke.
But, that's true. That's
yeah,
right.
But I smoke those. They have these cigarettes that are like phony cigarettes. They're like filled with rose petals or something. I don't know. And you can smoke them and they smell disgusting and the crew really hates you for it. But, you know, you can smoke those.
Did you inhale?
Oh, yeah. I mean, any excuse.
And my wife, that's the thing, yeah.
Exactly. My wife, who also quit, we made a deal that whenever I had to go smoke one of these phony cigarettes for a film, she was allowed to smoke exactly as many phony cigarettes. So I'd come home and I'd be like, I got to smoke 14 phony cigarettes. And so she'd just sit down and light up 14 phony cigarettes and smoke them all. I tell you, the weirdness of marriage, huh?
So it didn't make either of you start smoking again?
Mm-mm.
Good.
No, because it's just rose petals smoke, you mm-hmm. know, which, yeah.
But it gets you back in the habit of having
you go through
thing
all,
in your hands and your mouth.
All those cherished motions you get all over again.
My guest is Chris Eigmann. He's starring in two films, Mr. Jealousy and The Last Days of Disco. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Chris Eigmann. He's starring in two current films, Mr. Jealousy and The Last Days of Disco. So yeah. Now I understand that you've made a new pilot that's actually going to be broadcast.
Yeah, there'll be a, I guess ABC's picked it up for a mid-season replacement.
Does that mean this summer?
It means, I think, anytime from October on, we can appear.
Uh-huh.
So they put an order in for 12 episodes, which is a lot. So I guess they're trying to bank them up so that we're ready to go whenever they want us.
What's the program?
It's called It's Like You Know, and it's about a New York writer who goes to L.A. The guy who wrote it, Peter Melman, was a
writer. He wrote for Seinfeld.
Yeah, he was the executive producer of Seinfeld, exactly. And it's sort of Peter's story about a New York journalist who goes to L.A. to write for, in Peter's case, he was writing for Jerry Seinfeld. I'm not doing that. The character doesn't write for a comedian. He just tries to write, but is unable to escape the clutches of Los Angeles. And the character comes to L.A. with a certain amount of hatred for the city that's unfounded, but is there nonetheless. And it's to do with his friends who live out there, and we've only done the pilot, so what's in store I've yet to see. But when I read it, again, it fell into the category of jobs I would kill for.
Mm-hmm.
When I had written, Noah and I wrote a script together for NBC a couple years ago, of a sitcom that they bought but they never made. And when I read Peter's script, it was the best pilot script I'd ever read. And I tried writing these things, you know, so I knew it was fantastic. So I met with Peter and his executive producer and you know, went through the process of getting the job.
So it sounds like another role that's very verbal.
Very verbal. Big, long, beefy speeches, hopefully. And, you know, a lot appeals to me about doing a sitcom. I got to tell you, it's, you know, the workaday world just beckons. I love the idea of waking up every morning and having a job to go to. Unfortunately, that job's in California, which is a bit of a problem. But, you know, still the idea of just going to work is so appealing.
You've been living in New York?
Yeah, yeah. And I think for a while I'll just commute back and forth until, you know, hopefully the life of the show will go on and then we'll move out there.
Yeah, you mentioned how appealing it is to have like a job, daily work to have.
Oh, God.
I always wonder what actors do when they're not working and there's so much time they have when they're
they
not working.
They go out of their minds.
Well, how do you spend your days when you're not working?
Well, I walk my dog a lot, which is great for the dog. I mean, she's so happy when I'm unemployed.
A very fit dog.
She's right. She's in top physical condition when I'm not working. So I do that. I will, you know, cook dinner, clean up, you know, try to find another job. All the sort of cliches are true. I mean, you know, I try not to have my wife come home after working, come home at 6 o'clock and I'm still in my bathrobe. I try not for things like that to happen. But you just sort of, I don't know, you putter around the house. And I love it. You know, I don't mind puttering, except there are times when I actually miss or feel left out of things like rush hour. Since I have no reason to go onto rush hour traffic or to get in the subway in rush hour, everybody else does. I sort of feel left out sometimes.
Now, do you have certain guilt rules? For example, are you not allowed to enjoy yourself during working hours because maybe you should be working?
Nice, yeah. Have you talked to other actors who told you that?
No.
Really? No, that's totally true. You know, I won't sit around the house and read, for example, whatever good book I'm reading, because that's sort of relaxation time. You know, I'll go and read Dombey and Son during the middle of the day or something that's not necessarily that pleasant. And I'll do, you know, I'll read the John Irving at night or whatever.
Are you allowed to go to a matinee during the day? That's kind of work. You have to keep up with the industry.
You know, you can argue to my accountant that going to movies is work, but really I try not to do that. Noah and I will sometimes go to a movie in the afternoon. But I you know, I still feel sort of a little uncomfortable being one of eight people at a 2 o'clock showing of, you know, Armageddon. It always makes me feel just a little weird.
So are you at the point where people are recognizing you now?
Yeah, now, I mean, it's always sort of broken along two different lines. In New York, people, because my first movie was Metropolitan, the way people started recognizing me was they thought we prepped together. You know, they were sure I went to whatever, you know, Hotchkiss or whatever high school they went to. And then we go through the dance of, no, I didn't go to high school with you. No, I didn't go to Harvard with you. Yes, you know me from that movie. And now we're getting away from that, where people just sort of recognize me because I've been around or whatever. So,
well, Chris Eigmann, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Chris Eigmann is starring in two current films, Mr. Jealousy and The Last Days of Disco.